Heute zu Gast der Gründer von Slack, Stuart Butterfield.
Slack's revenue is now, you know, run rate of well over $1.5 billion a year. To get to 10 million, to get to 100 million, and probably to get to 200 or more was entirely product-led. And I think even now, marketing-led growth, sales-led growth probably accounts for 25 or 30% of Slack's growth, and product is still the other 70, 75%. The best case scenario for any sophisticated piece of software, like something like Slack, is to limit the number of available options in a pretty dramatic way until people understand that first set and then you kind of layer things on.
Let's go! Go!
Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
Ich habe im Intro unterschlagen, dass der Stuart ja nicht nur Slack gegründet hat, sondern einige Jahre vorher auch schon Flickr, eine Photosharing-Plattform, die dann nachher von Yahoo gekauft wurde. Also schon ein paar Jahre her, aber trotzdem zwei Plattformen, die dann weltweit genutzt wurden und beide wahrscheinlich so im Milliardenbereich wert sind. Wie macht man das? Was gibt es da für Ähnlichkeiten, für Prinzipien, die offensichtlich bei ihm zum Erfolg führen? Gerade bei Slack ist total spannend zu sehen, wie kriegt man das hin, so im B2B-Bereich, Slack ist ja ein B2B-Produkt, so viel Traktion zu bekommen, dass so viele Firmen Slack nutzen. Welche nutzen Slack überhaupt? Welche vielleicht noch nicht? Darüber haben wir gesprochen. Und halt, wie schafft man dieses Wachstum? Aber auch, wie und wo lebt man eigentlich als amerikanischer Digitalmilliardär? Wie blickt man auf die Welt? Wie blickt man auf Deutschland? Woran investiert er sein Geld? Woran glaubt er politisch? Ganz viele Fragen. Würde er seine Kinder auch den ganzen digitalen Apps aussetzen oder macht er das vielleicht alles ganz anders, was ja so als Gerücht häufig mal durch die Welt geistert, dass die ganzen amerikanischen Superstars ganz anders leben, als man das so vielleicht denkt und gar nicht ihre eigenen Produkte nutzen und so weiter. Am Ende auch natürlich eine Folge, die englischsprachig ist. Und wir wissen, dass englischsprachige Folgen häufig weniger gehört werden als deutschsprachige Folgen. Deswegen machen wir nur englischsprachige Gästinnen oder Gäste, wenn es wirklich herausragende Gespräche und Persönlichkeiten sind. In diesem Falle glauben wir als Team, war das so. Deswegen gebt dem Podcast bitte eine Chance und damit direkt rein ins Gespräch mit dem Stuart. Hi Stuart.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Where am I finding you?
In Aspen, Colorado, my home. A move I made the end of 2020. So definitely a pandemic move.
So your new office is in Aspen and the company headquarters is in California somewhere?
Yeah, I mean my home is in Aspen. There's no office. I mean, except for the room in my house.
Okay. But you spend most of the time there and then you sometimes commute to California?
Rarely to California. I've been there a couple times in the last few years. I spend maybe a third of the time in New York. Go to the offices there.
So it's a very decentralized company.
Yeah, there's usually, so our headquarters in California has room for about 1,200 people, and we had probably space for another 300 or 400 in nearby office buildings. But now that headquarters has 30 or 40 people in it a day. So,
okay.
There's it's not very important for me to be there.
Okay. When German people read your story, it sounds like this fairy tale or this ideal vision of an American founder from Silicon Valley. Like you grew up on a farm and no TV and no electronics. And then all of a sudden you came to Silicon Valley, you learned programming as a kid, and then you had those superstar companies. Is that truly the fairy tale everybody thinks it is?
No, I don't think so. I've had an incredibly fortunate life, and I think that a lot of it relies on just excellent timing. So not timing that I control, but just I started university in 1992. So just kind of even 6 months before the web started taking off as a popular phenomenon. So was there right when it started. And I think that it kind of set me up for a lifetime of exploring the use of computing technology to facilitate human interaction. Because what I saw there with Usenet and IRC and email, and then a little bit later, the web, was the ability to transcend time and space. And even though I grew up in British Columbia, which is kind of on the far western edge of North America and further on an island, and felt very provincial and disconnected from the from the main parts of the world, we're able to instantly connect with anyone. So, you know, for the 30 years that followed, it's been massively multiplayer games, massively multiplayer photo sharing, massively multiplayer workplace software. It's all about the use of computing technology to facilitate human interaction.
Do you think it plays a role or played a role that like your childhood was so free of you know, electronic gadgets? And would you like apply the same to your kids today?
I don't know, so much a product of the time. And there weren't very, I was born in 1973, so there weren't really electronic gadgets. You know, obviously there was things that plugged into the wall, but TVs were cathode ray tubes and like, you know, large and heavy. And my 16-month-old has an almost supernatural affinity for anything that has a screen. I'm sure anyone who has young kids has noticed this. It's kind of bizarre. Yeah. It must hit some very low evolutionary part of our brain. But I'm hoping that the kids of this generation are a little bit better off or better equipped than we were to cope with all this digital technology. Because if you're anything like me, Philip, you spend far too much time on your phone, far too much time online. And I think that with most technologies, if you look back literally through all of history, when they first become available, we get kind of all of the consequences, all of the good and all of the bad. If you look at the early days of the Industrial Revolution, the pollution killed people, you know, like the rivers caught on fire and stuff like that. And then 100 years later, we got the benefits of the Industrial Revolution without all the pollution. I hope that 10 or 20 years from now, we're able to take all the incredible advantages of being able to communicate with anyone on the surface of the earth at light speed and with this incredible set of facilities, which, you know, just aren't natural to us, and only use them as appropriate, not spend 9 hours a day glued to your phone, doom scrolling or playing dumb games or endlessly reading the news or anything like that.
But do you keep the phone away or like the screens away from your older child? I mean, is that something that you try to control or restrict a little bit? Or is that you just like let it, it's all whatever the kid wants?
No, definitely tried to have some discipline about it.
So 2 hours a day, 30 minutes a day?
Well, the 16-month-old, he can't really use it at all.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, okay. Is it a true story about like superstar founders or digital people in California that have the financial means that they like send their kids to schools where there's no cell phones, that where there's like different set of rules than like for the rest of the population?
I don't know about schools that don't have access, but there's definitely let's say a heightened awareness about the disadvantages. And I know a lot of people personally, and have heard of many more who are much more militant around keeping their kids away from technology than most people are. I think there's a little bit of a question of resources there too, because if you are working two low-wage jobs and can't afford childcare, it's pretty hard to say no to putting your kid in front of the TV or giving them an iPad or something like that. Whereas if you can afford to have nannies and childcare and activities for the kid, then it's much easier.
When I tried to, you know, understand your journey and prepared for this podcast, I tried to find what's your secret sauce? How come somebody like you can have those two mega hits and a couple other hits in between? What sets you apart from other founders or other people that try to build great companies? And then I suspect maybe the fact that you must be the product guy. You seem to be very product obsessed, very like close to the product, and you care a lot about the product. Product meaning the app or the software itself. You're not the entrepreneur that's great at raising capital or like selling a big vision. I mean, it really has its strength. And my suspicion was your strengths could be product. Is that a good observation, you think?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I don't remember now, but Slack raised a couple $1 billion, but it was in the biggest time in history to raise lots of money. And I think I think storytelling is an underrated and incredibly important skill for any founder. So I'm going to answer your question, but just always find this an interesting example. Elon Musk is a very interesting character. And whatever else you think about him, obviously he's been very successful. And I think a lot of people put that down to his skill in engineering. Like, he's just such a good engineer that he's able to design these cars or rocket ships or whatever. But if you look at Tesla, which he didn't found but got involved with really early on, it's a horrible, horrible industry. I mean, it's so regulated. There's, you know, these very difficult safety standards. It's incredibly capital intensive. There's a long development cycle. Like, you need to raise billions of dollars before you're able to build your first car. In the US, at least, the distribution system is completely broken. There's all these state level laws around car dealerships. The relationship with the parts suppliers is really essential because no auto manufacturer makes all their own parts. And so you got to convince a lot of people. You got to convince the regulators and the members of the supply chain, the investors, the media, potential employees, partners, all of that stuff, that this dream is worth pursuing. So I don't know Elon personally. I've met him maybe once. But he must be a very, very good storyteller in order to have had that success, because you have to just convince so many people for so many years before you have something to show for it. So I think there's some element of that. But yes, I am very focused on product. And I think if there's a special skill, it's the ability to predict or understand how someone else is going to perceive something. And immediately before this, when I was trying to join the call, I opened Google Calendar in a Chrome tab, and like three things popped up about how you can now set a work from home location or something. I don't even know what the hell it was, because I was opening the calendar to get the link to start this call with you, which is the worst time to ask me some other question or try to tell me about something, because no one opens their calendar just to see what new features there might be in the calendar. After I open the event and click on the link, wait 10 seconds and then pop something up on the screen, because you're doing it at the exact moment when I want to try to do something else. And it's such a trivial example, but you'd be amazed in the context of software development how many times teams will propose to announce something to a user inside of a menu, you know, which they only would have ever opened if they already had a pre-existing intent to do something. So your pop-up can only be interfering with their existing intent. And I think it's hard for a lot of people to really separate what they want as the producer of the app, you know, someone to watch more ads or spend more time in the app or something like that, and the goals or intentions of the person using it. And obviously, I think there's a path where you prioritize the latter. You prioritize what people actually want to do. They're happy with it, and then they continue using it, and you're not, you know, kind of struggling to get them to do something or to force them to do something.
Outside of Slack, what's the best product in that sense that you've come across that you look at and say, look, that's a really well-designed product?
Well, I think if you look at it in a holistic way, Figma is just really amazing. It's challenging to use if you don't understand that set of tools. So I think people mistake, people use words like intuitive, which I think is generally wrong, because most interesting software you have to learn how to use. And people say addictive, which seems like always just a bad thing. But I think Figma is incredibly well-designed as a product, but it's also incredibly well-executed. So there's a lot of technical decisions that go into the quality of the product that aren't what people might consider product decisions. So just to give you one example, there's a couple different pretty deep technologies to allow multiple people to edit the same document at the same time and to resolve any kind of conflicts between the edits that they make. And so if you're using a Google Doc or Quip or many different applications, actually, I don't know if this is still true for Google, but Operational Transform was the kind of the back end for how they would handle that. And it's very complex and it's very difficult to implement and difficult to maintain and hard to understand. And Figma came along and said, you know what? Like, multiple people can edit this document at the same time. And maybe sometimes there'll be three or four. And maybe sometimes someone will edit something just at the same second that someone else is editing the same thing, and there'll be a conflict. But that's going to be so rare that we're going to simplify the whole system, make it much more responsive, and not bother to try to get down to the level of preserving it and reconciling every click that two different people with two different amounts of latency might make. I know this is a very complicated example, so I kind of regret starting it.
I get it.
Yeah, they just made like a deliberate decision to simplify the back end in order to create a smoother experience on the front end and to divert their resources to things that really matter.
Okay. I mean, do you go on a lot of tools just to check out how they're done and you just like you get inspired or like check out like, you know, a product and see who's doing it and what it makes it special?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the gold standard is usually games, because if you think about Super Mario Brothers going back way into history, you often learn how to do one thing, which is move your character, you know, left and right. And then you learn how to jump. And then the next level, you learn how to punch or shoot or whatever. And over time, you kind of assemble these skills, but they're presented to you one at a time. And I think the best case scenario for any sophisticated piece of software, like something like Slack, is to limit the number of available options in a pretty dramatic way until people understand that first set and then you kind of layer things on. Because there's one view of video games that is the whole process of playing the game is learning how to play it. You know, you become better and more talented, and then there's a harder boss to defeat and or a harder puzzle to solve or whatever. And you learn how to solve that one. You learn how to solve the next one. You learn how to like beat the next boss in the next level. And then the game's over. And the whole thing was just learning about it. Whereas people are much less predisposed to want to learn how to use workplace software. So you have to try to use those techniques and help people develop some mastery over it and some understanding, because I think that's the biggest barrier. This isn't true for applications that people already understand. So let's just say everyone understands how an online store works. But for things that they don't already understand, something like Slack, the challenge is really comprehension. It's not removing friction, and the mentality that I think a lot of people bring into product development is that it's about removing friction. If you're selling beer or cars, you don't need to explain to anyone why they would want beer or cars. But if you're selling them Slack or Figma or Atlassian, you need to kind of, in many cases, explain to them why they would want this thing in the first place. So if you imagine a lot of your audience does digital marketing. I'm one of the suckers who buys stuff off Instagram all the time. And there's some art and science to the design of the advertisements. But then the people working on the product in an e-commerce environment really are about removing friction, because I saw this t-shirt in the ad, I clicked on it, I added it to my shopping cart. And now it's really just a matter of how easy you can make it for me to check out, or how few barriers you put in my way. But if you are a new user of Slack and you end up on slack.com, our website, you probably don't really know what it is. I mean, most people know it's for work, but they're like, is it a spreadsheet or calendar? Or like, you know, they don't have a very clear idea. And at the extreme, you imagine you want to get tickets for the Justin Bieber concert. You know exactly what you want and you really want it. You know, like it's this specific concert, this city, this date. And it doesn't really matter how bad the Ticketmaster website is. Like, it could be really slow and it can give you weird error messages and stuff like that, but you're going to persevere because you really want this thing. Again, if you show up at Slack.com, it's usually you have the minimum amount of intent. Like, you just barely hit the threshold to click on the link or type something into Google or go to the website directly. And it's not a very specific intent. So anything is likely to throw you. And the challenge, again, isn't to remove friction, to make the button bigger or, you know, a different color or something like that, but to help people understand. And ideally, if there's a match between their understanding of what this software does, they'll kind of move ahead. And if they don't understand it, then they'll just stop.
What was describe a little bit how Slack and maybe before that Flickr gained so much traction. I mean, once you have the traction going and you have people like telling each other about the product, then you can't stop. Then it's like a like a snowball. But like putting everything in motion, like how did it first start with Slack or maybe even before that with Flickr? What set everything in motion? What was the, I mean, you didn't have much marketing money. You didn't do TV advertising or you didn't advertise on Instagram at the time, obviously. How did you get this whole thing going?
Well, I think I don't want to understate the value of luck and timing and connections and all of that, because I think it really is important. We had a lot of people who were influential, who were friends in the days of Flickr that, like, you know, helped us promote it. So everyone who worked on it was an early blogger. And so we knew all the other people with blogs. And this is 2002, 2003, 2004. And that was the easiest way to get attention. But I think there's also an enormous amount of work that went into creating an experience that people really enjoyed. So part of that was in the days of Flickr, every single person who signed up got a personal greeting from someone on the team. You know, they would say, hello, welcome. I work here. Let me know if you have any questions or need any help. And it was an actual human being. And I think at some point we stopped doing that because we're, you know, there's tens of millions of people and it was just, there was too much. But that created a real loyalty, a real affinity, and the strength of that community was powerful, because when it got too big for employees to come and greet every new person and offer to help them and explain how things worked, users did. You know, that kind of vibe kept going in the community. And I think in the case of Slack, again, good timing, good connections, kind of like, you know, friends with a lot of influence who could help promote it, but a real emphasis on getting people to the point where they understood what it was and how it could be useful to them. And you know, just relentless effort that went into understanding how people outside of the company would perceive it. So, but what I mean by that is we made the first version of Slack for ourselves. And then we, as soon as, you know, like 5 months into the development process, we tried to convince other friends at other startup companies to try to use it and then give us feedback. And we would look at what worked and what didn't work and what they, you know, what kind of preconceptions they had coming into it. Maybe even before our open beta period, we got a company called RDO, which was an old streaming music service that sadly went out of business, to start using Slack. And they were 110 employees or something like that, and we were 8. And so suddenly we realized all the parts of the product that would break if you had a 100-person company, like all the features we'd have to add for managing larger collections of channels. And we got friends in different industries, and we got new users in different industries, and took what we learned and just really put almost all of the emphasis in the early days in getting people over that initial hump. I think in both cases, and really in everything in life, there's usually some kind of magic threshold where if you get above
the point,
yeah, like things get easier. And if you're below that threshold, things go, you know, are much harder for you. And, you know, and all I mean is in the case of Slack, we got some early users excited. And so they started using it and they were retained, and investors liked that, which meant that they wanted to invest. And so we got more investment, and that caused the press to write about us. And that made it easier to attract, great employees, and that meant it was easier for us to create a great product and make more customers happy. And so we grew the customer base and we got, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, the other, you know, if you're below that threshold, you don't get the traction with users, and investors don't want to invest, and you don't get the press, and it's harder to attract good employees, and you kind of end up in a death spiral. And no one can tell you exactly where that threshold is. You have to intuit where it is and what you need to do to get on the right side of it. But I see that in everything. You know, like if you're trying to recruit an employee, the behavior you care about is binary. Either they take the job or they don't. You know, either the customer decides to pay or they don't. They decide to keep using it or expand their usage or they don't. But the inputs are all continuous. And so people, I think, dismiss little aspects of the experience because they think well, this couldn't possibly be the reason why someone wouldn't buy the product or take the job or whatever. But often it can, you know, because there is just hundreds of little factors that influence people's decisions, and any one of them could be the critical factor. So there's a much wider range of things that truly matter to the entrepreneur than they might anticipate at first.
Do you think you'd have a third like home run in you in terms of like a third company that would also like take off like that?
Yes, but that's less because I'm so confident about my like special genius or something like that, and more just I have so many advantages now. You know, like easy for me to raise money. Like there's zero challenge in that. There's zero challenge in me getting attention from the press or getting, you know, people to write about it or to get people to try it. And it's much, much easier for me to convince talented people to come work on the project and all of that. So there is like this advantages that keep on accruing to people.
Okay. But is that something that you can imagine doing, or are you going to stay on with Slack for a longer time? What's the plan?
No special plan right now. Definitely not interested. I have no idea that I'm dying to pursue, or no company that I'm like waiting to start. I'm 49, so maybe I'll do another one. maybe I won't. I would love to take a year or two off at some point, though, to travel, spend time with kids and stuff like that, because obviously that hasn't been as easy as it could be over the last 15 years.
I can imagine. There's this, I mean, just continuing the conversation a little bit on the product. There's this new, I don't know, I perceive it a little bit as a buzzword, but it's called product-led growth. Is that something that you've come across as well, and that you applied, or that you look at?
Yeah, I mean that was definitely the basis of Slack's success, because we tried like big advertising, like TV ads and things like that, once we were already successful, and I don't know that they had a huge amount of influence, but when we were small, obviously we couldn't afford that. And you know, going back to something I said at the beginning, if you're trying to sell someone beer or cars, you have a huge advantage because they already know why they would want it. So it's just like, why this car or why this beer? Whereas no one knew that they wanted channel-based communication hubs for work or like whatever you want to call that category. So advertising just didn't work. You know, we tried buying AdSense and Facebook ads and other stuff back in 2014 when we were first getting off the ground. And the only way to get growth was to have it be led by the product. So part of that is built into Slack. If you get a 5-person team inside of a 100-person company to start using Slack, then the objective obviously is to expand to all 100 people. And that's worked incredibly well. So if you look at, you know, any customer of ours that has 100,000 people using Slack, and there's many, many of those, all started with 5 people or 10 people or 20 people using Slack. And the second part is when someone left a company that was using Slack in the early days and joined a company that wasn't using Slack, which was most companies, then they would say, oh, the way we're working here is crazy. We really got to try Slack. And they would keep on agitating until their new employer tried using it. And, you know, that would take off as well. So I think if I look at Slack's revenues now, you know, run rate of well over $1.5 billion a year, to get to 10 million, to get to 100 million, and probably to get to 200 or more was entirely product led. And I think even now, marketing led growth, sales led growth probably accounts for 25 or 30% of Slack's growth, and product is still the other 70, 75%.
And what was the most important hook? I mean, you said that you aim at 5 people using it. So your KPI must be, we need to get 5 people on Slack within a company. But what was the mechanism to make that happen or to achieve that?
Also going back a little bit, trying to build comprehension about what it was for and why you would use it. So there's a bunch of, to me, once someone points it out, there are really obvious advantages to using something like Slack. So the alternative to Slack, certainly when we started, and it's still for most people today, is email. And one advantage of Slack is, imagine you join a company, you know, doesn't really matter if it's big or small. If they're using Slack, you have access to all of this rich history. You can search through, you know, if it's a large organization, millions or tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of messages. You can scroll back over the last 6 months of conversation of your team. You can see the social expectations and how people treat one another and the patterns of communication. Whereas if you start a new job where the principal means of communication is email, you start with nothing, like an empty inbox. And if anyone wants to give you any of the history, they have to manually forward emails one at a time, and they're all like janky and indented, and you have to read from the bottom up. And that's a huge advantage. The other one is people over time develop channels where everything matters to the organization. And so there's always a place to go to ask your question or to get caught up on something or to give your update. Whereas in a world of email, that isn't as true. I can keep going with these, but each of those were things that we had to explain. And if I explain them the way I just did, it's, you know, unless someone's already interested in what I'm saying, they're not going to listen because it's boring. So you need to find ways to get little fragments of that into people's heads so that they take the next step. And obviously, if what you're trying to do is get two or three or four or five people to start using it in the beginning, it's really about when they send an invite and prompting them to create a channel and what they should put in the channel and helping kickstart those behaviors.
I looked through your Twitter feed and you mentioned a book and a theory, a marketing theory that you applied today or that plays a role for you up until today. And the book is called Positioning. Can you say a few words why positioning is so important to you and what positioning means?
Yeah. I think it really, really matters what's in other people's heads. And there's this thing that internally at Slack, we call the owner's delusion. And that name came from someone's reply on Twitter. Unfortunately, that person deleted their reply. So now I have no idea who it was who first came up with the phrase. But I had posted on Twitter, this is, I don't know, 8 years ago or something. Ugh, I hate restaurant websites because there's only four reasons you would ever go to a restaurant's website. It's like, what days are they open? What's their address? What's their phone number? What's on the menu? But when you go to a restaurant website, it's like the slow fade in of like a Ken Burns effect over a photo loading in the background, and there's music and it says like, please wait while we create your multimedia experience or something like that. This is honestly, this is less of a problem in 2022 because Google Maps and Google Local and all the competitors have just aggregated all this stuff, and restaurant website service creators have focused on stuff that really matters. But there's this real disconnect between what people wanted and the experience. And I was really curious, how do people end up here? Because the people who make the restaurant website and the owner of the restaurant must themselves have gone to other restaurants' websites because they wanted the phone number or the address. Or so why do they think that other people are going to want to sit through their dumb, you know, multimedia experience at the beginning? And the phrase that someone came up with is the owner's delusion. Like, we tend to think our thing is so precious. Whereas on the other hand, when you're, you know, click a link in a tweet to a news article or something like that, and there's an ad at the top, maybe you give it 80 milliseconds of attention. And if some subconscious, preconscious perception processing part of your brain warrants it, you'll look at it for another 200 milliseconds or something like that. And then if it seems like it's something really interesting to you, then maybe you'll spend a whole second looking at it. But most of the time, you just ignore it. You know, most of the time when a dialogue pops up in an app or a website, people just hit enter right away to get rid of it without even reading it. But when you're on the creator side, you feel like people are going to have infinite patience to read everything that you write and kind of interpret. And people put all this useless marketing terms in the description of their product, which aren't helpful at all in help, you know, getting people to understand what they're looking for. So that challenge, that prejudice towards believing that your thing is so interesting and so important that other people will give it infinite time and attention, is maybe the biggest impediment to getting new products off the ground for people, and not just really centering what they're going to think and their priorities and what their perception is. So going back to the book, positioning, it's really about what is the hook? Like, why does someone remember your thing? And especially when it's something new, it's very, very difficult to create the mental space inside of someone else's brain to persist your idea, especially if they don't understand it. So that's why you know, people will explain a movie like it's like Jaws meets Star Wars, or they'll explain a startup, it's Uber for pets or something like that. Because it's much easier to take concepts that already exist in your mind and combine them in order to create this new thing than to start totally from scratch.
It sounds like Apple must be the perfect company that follows all the advice in this book perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Steve Jobs has a reputation as a product genius, and I think he's obviously very good at product. He's definitely a marketing genius, and I think that's the people talk about product market fit. And if you imagine, you know, the yin yang symbol on the Korean flag, that black and white circle with a interlocking shapes. To me, there is like a surface between the market in the minds of human beings and the product, and you can adapt either side, like just adapt the product to fit the kind of pre-existing mental models that people have, or you can adjust the mental models. But I think Steve Jobs' genius was much more about where is it going to be easiest to find that real match? Like, you know, how can I shift the market? How can I shift people's thinking? And how can I iterate on the product to find something that really fits together beautifully? And I feel like a lot of you know, people who believe in product-led growth or lead product teams sometimes underestimate the importance of marketing. And by that, I don't mean just getting attention, you know, or advertising. I mean, in a much more holistic sense, what do you call this thing? How are people supposed to understand it? What are the aspirations behind it? There's a book, I can't remember the name of the author right now, but who do you want your customers to become? And it's an interesting question, because it's like, okay, before people use my product, they're like this. And after they use my product, they're like that. What is that? And so we thought about that a lot at Slack. We want them to be more confident, more aware, to have better relationships with the people that they're working with. And as you start to answer those questions, to think about who you want your customers to become, it's much easier to think about the advantages of your product in their terms rather than like a long list of features or things that you think are cool.
Okay. Is Apple using Slack?
I can't say whether they are or not, because if they were, we didn't have rights of publicity. But you can read lots of articles in the news about Apple's use of Slack.
What customer are you most proud of?
You know, unfortunately, we don't have the rights of publicity over a lot of our customers. But if I, you know, look around, I mean, just like the whole world, the leaders in more or less every industry. I mean, obviously, Slack has done very well in technology and media, and I'd say we have 90-ish% market share in tech, and probably also in media, like every newsroom in the world. But the world's largest issuer of credit cards, and you know, I'm not sure what the current number is. I think 8 of the top 10 telecommunications companies around the world, 8 out of the 10 biggest retailers in the world, all in on Slack. So like a huge number of companies that I really admire. And then on top of that, probably I'm not sure exactly what the percentage is. Let's say at least 80%, but I think it's probably much higher than that, of every academic research lab in the world that worked on fighting COVID, like epidemiologists and virologists and people tracking the spread or testing new compounds, were all using Slack. So 200,000+ customers, and many of the biggest companies in the world, but obviously there's only 500 in the Fortune 500. So when we talk about 200,000 customers, it's an enormous variety, you know, including like very classic German Mittelstand industrial manufacturing firms.
That was my next question. I mean, how developed in that sense, in the Slack sense, is the German market? I mean, are you like, what's the market penetration you have here? I mean, of the biggest German companies, are you at 50% of them or 60 or what is it?
Well, I don't know if you still count the UK as part of Europe or not. So if you count the UK as part of Europe, then Germany is our number two market in Europe. If you don't, then it's our number one. But 26 of the DAX 40 are paid customers. Wow. So, yeah, okay. Like 65%. A lot of companies that we're allowed to name that people would know. You know, Delivery Hero and HelloFresh, Jägermeister, Trivago.
Have you noticed that there is a German company from a small Eastern German city called Chemnitz? The company is called Staffbase. They're like a unicorn by valuation now. And they are providing a similar service, except that it's focused for mobile.
Similar service to Slack, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I have not seen them, no.
Oh, Staffbase. You need to take a look. Okay. Staffbase is, I mean, it's a German company. It's last valuation was, I don't know, above 1 billion. And international investors, like recently I had the German head of General Atlantic, the growth equity company, and he told me about the company and how bullish he is, and I thought I'd ask you that question because it seems to be.
So it looks like it's for more like frontline workers.
Yeah,
In retail or food service or factories or warehouses or delivery.
Mobile. I mean, let's call it like mobile focused work. Yeah, or maybe you don't have a computer in your hand, or you don't have a desk, but you have other working situations. Yeah.
All right, so I should figure out if they're a Slack customer or not.
Can you look it up now?
I'm just waiting for Slack to
start. Okay.
It's funny, you know, this is part of the value of Slack to me, that the integration with Sales Cloud, which we've used for CRM for, I don't know, 6 years or something like that, long before the Salesforce acquisition. The integration with Slack is so good that the way I go to look up stuff like this is to look at in Slack rather than in Sales Cloud.
Okay.
So let's see. Yep.
I mean, there must be. They're probably like also a customer only for researching purposes at least.
No, they spend a good amount of money. And they pay 800 people. I think if they're really optimizing for mobile workers, it's probably not going to be also optimized for software developers. And the integrations that people create with Slack are enormously valuable. You know, like IBM has 350,000 people using Slack and something like 10,000 custom integrations, so ones that they created to integrate their internal software with Slack. And the same thing is true for pretty much every software developer. So whether it's bug tracking or build and release tools, continuous integration testing, monitoring and alerting, like there's all these categories of software that integrate really well and that make it teams that develop software much more powerful.
Who's the biggest competitor to Slack today, you would say?
Microsoft Teams, but it's funny because from Microsoft's perspective, they really want people to believe that it's an alternative to Slack. It's not really. So like if you think about our large enterprise customers, almost all of them are Microsoft customers, like 95%+. And of those, the overwhelming majority are Office 365 customers. And of those, the overwhelming majority have Teams. At Slack, the company, we use Zoom for video calling. And so a lot of our customers use Slack And then they use Teams for voice and video calling. So there's not really kind of what we think of as big competitors.
So it's your own category in the end.
Yeah. And that has pluses and minuses. You know, going back to the beginning, if it's not an existing category, then you have to convince people that they want the category before they think that they might want your product.
Let's spend the last few minutes a little bit on bigger questions outside of Slack and every day, like competing and building, making Slack bigger. I mean, after you sold Slack to Salesforce, and you mentioned that you sold it to Salesforce because you wanted to accelerate the growth. You're like now like a man with a lot of financial means, and I can tell that you give away a lot of money here to all kinds of causes. What's the like now your vision for your life? I know that you have all these possibilities, all these resources. What has changed? What's your thinking for the next couple of years, except for like executing Slack for a little longer?
I'm still getting used to the idea, and I think there's interesting questions in philanthropy, because there's this thing called the effective altruist movement. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was very much, I studied philosophy back in college. And this is very much kind of utilitarian. How much human suffering can I alleviate for spending $1? And so when you ask that question, you often end up with stuff like buying malaria nets in Africa, because it's very cheap to buy them and they are really effective at preventing kids from getting malaria infections and then the kids don't die. So there's some of that, right? Probably basic research, medical research, fighting cancer, things like that. And then there's real addressing inequality and poverty alleviation. But I'm not sure if you can really, given how much suffering there is in the world and how much opportunity there is for humans to really make the most effective decisions. Because I think something that really resonates with me is the idea that the purpose of life ultimately is creative expression. And John Adams, who is the second president of the United States, has this quote, which I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember exactly how he said it. And it was something like, I must study politics and war so that my sons may study commerce and navigation, so that their sons may study porcelain and tapestry and poetry. And what he means is there's kind of this base state of society, very much like Maslow's hierarchy, if you're familiar with that, where there's mm-hmm. like, you know, food and shelter are down at the bottom, and then social belonging is in the middle. And at the top of the pyramid is self-actualization. But what Adams was saying was, okay, first politics and war. Once we've kind of settled and have a society that works, then it's really about creation of wealth and commerce and the economy. And the reason that we do that is so ultimately that people can, in his era, create, you know, tapestries and porcelain objects. But that could be create music or poetry or other forms of play or really any
amusement. Yeah.
Yeah, anything that's a creative expression. I think that people are their happiest. So I'm really interested, in how to promote that, because I look around the U.S. and there's not very many schools left that teach music. There's not very many schools left that teach art in any significant way, and I think that's really a shame, because it feels so important to people to have some kind of creative outlet.
Are you concerned about the state that the U.S. is in currently? I mean, if you're sitting here in Europe, we got all these reports. I mean, like, we are in a warlike situation as ourselves. But like, I mean, looking at the U.S., it feels like there's such a, you know,
yeah,
divide.
I mean, definitely. I mean, I also look at Hungary and Italy. So I mean, I feel like this is a worldwide phenomenon, probably U.S. led. It feels a little bit hopeless politically. Certainly I'm not sure what to do about it. And if I take any comfort, it's from the idea that people have felt like this a lot. You know, like if we say this is the most divisive point in American history, probably the most divisive point was the actual Civil War, where people were like shooting each other. 600,000 people died. So that seems, you know, worse than it is today. The 1960s were really dramatic cultural upheaval and political upheaval as well. I definitely have confidence in the long-term ability of humans to figure out a better path forward. I think that history generally tends towards the better. And then certainly that John Rawls test, you know, if you could be born behind a veil of ignorance, you don't know where in the world you're going to be born or what station, what kind of family, what's going on, what year would you like to be born? And I think the answer is 2022. You know, and last year it was 2021, and the year before it was 2020. I'm very happy I was born in 1973 instead of 1541 or 876 or 300 BC or anything like that. Because obviously there were people who had very good lives in every era, but the majority of humans didn't have good, interesting lives.
Anything that I should have asked you that I missed out on? I didn't ask about Figma and Adobe. I mean, obviously, you probably preferred if Salesforce had bought Figma, right?
Yeah. I think that price was much more something that made sense for Adobe than Salesforce. Figma is like this is what I was trying to say about them earlier. I think the best executing team in web-based software development. Like they've just been able to do things that certainly I would have thought was not possible when they first got started, you know, to build a tool as rich and full featured as they have. And to, you know, complete the Figma is something that we use all over the company every day. And in retrospect, it's all kind of obvious. But when it was happening, it was not obvious. And they had a real vision that was very interesting and very successful on that basis.
We also didn't talk about returning to office and all this, but I think you mentioned or made your point clear in a couple other interviews. Obviously, you're not you're a fan of work from home, work from everywhere. So I spared those questions.
I think there's real value in getting people together. So it's not like I'm against seeing other people in person, but I know personally, I'm never commuting to an office 5 days a week again. Like it's just, if you have the choice, why would you?
Yeah, I mean, it can create joy, it can create efficiency. Or, I mean, that's probably the arguments for those who, I mean, Elon Musk and Tim Cook, then you know, they are advising their people to come back to the office up to 5 days a week.
It's true, and the same thing is true with a lot of the banks. And we'll see where we're at 10 years from now. But I think it's going to be so hard, you know, for people who had kids during the pandemic, you know, or just had young children when the pandemic started. It's so different to have a life where you can go and spend time with your child between meetings than it is the struggle to try to get home before they go to bed. And I'm not sure how many people will give that up. I also think it's in the employer's interest to be able to hire from all over the world rather than just a small number of geographic locations.
So you're thinking that maybe Elon Musk or those companies, they could like change their course there in the future?
Yeah. And, you know, maybe for any particular company, there's enough of a population that really wants to work there that they can continue to be successful. And that could be true of Tesla. But I think it's equally likely to be true that 2 years from now, they kind of relent because it's still a competitive market for hiring people. And so many of the best software engineers, for example, are not going to be willing to commute to one of their offices.
Let's see. Very interesting. Thank you very much, Stuart.
Well, good. That ends up more interesting conversation.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars. Bei OMR.